If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
I was educated by liberal professors. Some would call them left-wingers, but they're really liberal. I mean, they were on the left. Okay, everybody in the colleges were on the left. From Columbia College, my God, it was so hard left then. But they engaged in ideas. The ideas they wanted you to discuss, they wanted you to read everything and discuss the ideas. And they would never shut you down. You could say whatever you wanted. You could think whatever you wanted. Something happened in the last 30 years with the assassination culture growing among the Democrats and people thinking that it would be okay to murder the president or murder Elon Musk, according to the poll in Rutgers. And all that bothered me, and it bothers Jeff Carlin, and we thought we'd call on our friend, Professor Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, political writer, thinker. You could find all his work at charleslipson.com. And Jeff Carlin is here, executive producer at WGN Radio, baker of pies, lover of cats. And me, I'm John Cass, publisher and executive editor. I give myself many titles. Of johncassnews.com. And if you want to support independent journalism, take a look. $50 a year. And pour yourself a good cup of Midwestern common sense. And if you think that good cup of common sense is important, now's your chance to become a sponsor of John Cass News. Send me an email at john@johncassnews.com. And where are you? As Charlie Kirk's widow throws down the gauntlet to the hard left and the assassination culture, as professors and students alike wonder what they can say and not say, as the people of England are muffled by their own government. You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
As promised, our guest, Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, one of the great professors of America. I'd like to call you America's professor. Hello, Charles.
Well, I'm emeritus. I don't know if America. Yeah. It sounds pretty close. It sounds pretty close. I appreciate the kind words, Chuck.
Well, they were intended. Well, yeah, kindly intended.
The check's in the mail, my friend. The check's in the mail.
So how are we to balance what we've been going through? I find the political assassination of Charlie Kirk to be an expression of the assassination culture, Democrat assassination culture. And then we have, I guess, across the pond, as the president's going there, people are being rounded up, and you wrote about this, for daring to speak their minds, which I thought was an Englishman's right. But I guess it's not.
It should be. It should be. I think there's a kind of link between the two, because free speech will often lead to very vile speech, but we have, I think, a reasonable limit in the United States in how we interpret and how the courts have interpreted the First Amendment. I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on podcasts, but you can say pretty vile things if you don't directly threaten someone or don't say it in the context of, let's say, a threatening rally or something. That seems to me to strike a good balance. In England, they've been arresting people for flying the flag. They arrested one person last week for reading the Bible because it made someone anxious, and that anxiety was apparently enough to get the police to come out and arrest the person. The person who was the famous arrest of the comedian. The comedian was Irish, not English, and was being arrested for a post that he made in Arizona. When I wrote the article about free speech and its death at the hands of the current English government, it made me wonder if I would be arrested at Heathrow for just writing it. Well, that's, I think the thing for all of us to remember is that free speech is very rare in human history. It was a hard-won achievement, one really in the Anglo-American world, starting with the Glorious Revolution in England in 1689, but really flourishing in the 19th century, best defended by John Stuart Mill in his book on liberty, but really flourishing in the United States. But there are always people who don't just have opposing views. They want to suppress your view. Let me say one more thing about it. I think what's happening now, though, has to be understood in the context of the change in our technology. We don't just have three main channels anymore that everybody listens to. What we have is a very fragmented media environment. So the people who want to listen to Rachel Maddow are not the people who are listening to John Cass and Jeff Carlin. They're different people. And so we get this fragmented environment. And then with cable TV, we also have a world in which people are rewarded for being the most extreme voices. And sadly, those are amplified in the party primaries. So you've got this world that seems like a deep chasm between views and where people, it's kind of paradoxical. They post things publicly, but almost say them as if they're private. So we ought to kill X, Y, or Z, and they just say it. And then you have people like Tim Walz openly calling during the campaign, calling Donald Trump a fascist. Well, what do you do to fascists? I mean, this is just,
you kill them.
Yeah, this is really bad, really bad.
Yeah, and Charles, I mean, you're kind of expanding on that. You know, the idea that people are cloistered in their own, you know, personalized echo chambers that because of algorithms get more and more personalized and more, you know, self-rewarding for the crazier things they see. It builds it. And then when they are exposed to an alternative view, they're almost become their own extremists in their view, because now it's all of a sudden, well, wait, that's way far from what I believe or have even been exposed to. And now there's this, you know, this culture shock. And then how do people process that? Well, usually through anger and ultimately violence. And it's this kind of devolving of our culture. I mean, everybody in the Charlie Kirk, post Charlie Kirk world, because we wanted to have you on before we'd set this up, because of the free speech column you wrote, John and I were like, this is perfect. This is the way to kind of tackle this. And then Charlie Kirk is assassinated. And it kind of changed the idea, and people are all now, you know, we're blaming the rhetoric, and people are blaming, you know, the words people are saying. And to
who's
me,
blaming the rhetoric, Jeff.
Well,
who's blaming the rhetoric? The left is telling people that Charlie Kirk died because he spoke out. He's being blamed for his own death, which is abominable. But that, I respectfully, I.
First of all, it's not the left. I mean, it's certainly people of the left. There are plenty of people who consider themselves left who are not blaming Charlie Kirk for his own death. And there are plenty of people who are not. There are people who, as a, when it swings both ways. I mean, we had Democratic politicians murdered in their own homes and almost killed in their own homes, and the world didn't stop the way it stopped with Charlie Kirk. So there is a weird hinge point here, but that's not my point. My point is that the rhetoric that people blaming this on conversation, people saying stuff or saying, oh, he's, you know, he blaming him for what he said, or now people are saying, like Tim Walz was saying, oh, Tim Walz is saying, you know, it's, he's a fascist and now we should kill fascists. That stuff's all a symptom of the cultural decline. You know, we're at a time in our world, and especially in this country, where violence is, you know, $1 billion business between video games and movies and TV shows and crime shows. I mean, we're talking at a place where, you know, we spend 4 times as much money on alcohol in this country than we do on mental health. We have more guns than people in this country. And so it's not the conversations, the stuff that's being said, that's causing this. It's the devolvement of our society writ large.
Well, I think there's a lot to that. Let me sort of build on that with a couple of points. The first is, I would distinguish between the kind of street violence that we now see, and which has spread to many downtowns, and which has overwhelmed cities like Chicago and so forth, and political violence. Any killing is bad. The difference is that political violence cuts at the very heart of what we think a constitutional democracy should be, where different views are debated and where disputes are resolved either by voting or in the courts, but they're resolved peacefully. So those seem to me to be different. But I want to say something positive about a couple of things. The first thing is what hasn't happened in the aftermath of Charlie Kirk's shooting. This is not like the aftermath of George Floyd.
Exactly.
The people have been angry, and understandably so, but it's not as if they've gone out and rioted and burned things. The second thing is that we've had, as you underscored, Jeff, people from Bernie Sanders on the left to lots of people on the right condemning this. And I want to especially praise people on the left, because they're sort of speaking against interest, if you will. That is, but on the negative side, there were people who started yelling on the floor of the House of Representatives when they wanted to have a moment of silence and prayer for Charlie Kirk's death. That was just outrageous. But the real highlight has been the governor of Utah, Spencer Cox, who I thought, without taking anything off of the idea that if this killer, accused killer, is found guilty, that the death penalty is on the table. I think 26 states have the death penalty, and Utah is one of them. But while still saying that the full weight of justice would be brought to bear on this killer if he is found guilty, and I hope it will find that no other people were knowledgeable in advance or involved in any way. But Spencer Cox really spoke to the better angels of our nature, and he did it without a tepid statement. He just talked about what American values were and what we ought to look to at this time. So I had really not heard or known of Spencer Cox, but I was left deeply impressed. And I must say, I don't know any of his other viewpoints or other things, but what he said in this one moment when he was really called upon, and he did it twice, was really worthy of our praise.
True leadership, yeah.
With over three decades of serving up streetwise insight and local perspective on Page 2, the voice of John Cass has a home at johncassnews.com.
There's a new sheriff in town.
This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have.
But as he settles in, can you deal with the hysteria, the meltdowns, the constant whining?
I don't know what to do.
You know what you need? You need a good cup of common sense.
It's just common sense.
Like the kind of common sense you get when you subscribe to johncassnews.com. I'm John Cass, 40 years a journalist in Chicago.
The Chicago way.
I opened this website, John Cass News, so that you could have a decent cup of common sense.
This great country of ours was built on its entrepreneurial spirit.
It's time that you join the frontier of independent journalism at johncassnews.com.
Subscribe today to get access to great columns from John Cass, Dan Proft, and others. Don't be a chumbalone and subscribe at johncassnews.com.
I thought it was tremendous, Governor Cox, and also I was stunned into silence, I guess, by the widow of Charlie Kirk, who came forward yesterday. As we speak, this is Saturday, so the day before, and delivered an amazingly powerful, gentle tribute to her husband. And I think she made it clear to all those who were wishing Charlie ill and all the people around that whole movement, that, you know, the hard left, not accepting Bernie Sanders, but others. She left it very clear that there would be political retribution. And I can see it happening. People going to church and then registering to vote. What do you guys think?
I do think so. We've already seen a massive, two massive developments in terms of political alignments. One has been over 4 million people switch, over 2 million leaving the Democratic Party. This is all before the Charlie Kirk event. Over 2 million people leaving the Democratic Party and more than 2 million registering as Republicans. Now, not the same people. Many of the people who are leaving the Democratic Party are splitting between some becoming independents, whatever that means to them, and some becoming Republicans. The second thing, and this was kind of, this was surprising to me when I read the polling, was that there's been an overwhelming movement among people, say, under 30 years old, registering as Republicans. The reason that was so surprising is that what we really hear about is younger people on Ivy League campuses moving very far to the left. And we see that in New York, where you could have a socialist elected as mayor and a guy who thinks he can run local grocery stores and so forth. But it seems like what people are doing is not just registering as Republicans, they're flowing out of Massachusetts and New York and Connecticut and Illinois and California, and they're moving to Austin and Dallas and Nashville and Atlanta and Tampa and Miami. So, I mean, people are voting with their feet. I saw an interesting data that I had not seen before about over maybe the last decade. The GDP growth per capita, income growth per capita in Massachusetts was half of 1%. In Texas, it was 4%. That's per capita. So eight times as high. And of course, people are moving. People understand that. So if they, when they graduate college or when they move into the workforce, whenever that is, they're moving to places where there are jobs and where all the jobs aren't in public sector unions.
So, John, your question about the political ramifications and the what happens next in that sphere. I mean, Charles, you're right. We've seen this, in even in Democrats, prominent Democrats, coming out and saying, you know, what are we doing as a party, or what are we seeing? You know, I can't agree with you on everything you say, and therefore I'm no longer part of your kin. And they've been eating themselves alive. And I'm not surprised by an outflow. And I'm not surprised about the inflow either for Republicans, because it feels like, at the very least, they have a message that is defined and people know what they're about. And the Democrats, it's, you know, it's so regional almost, or it's, you know, there's a socioeconomic positioning there. And I'm just really curious about what this next election brings. I mean, this midterm election will be such an interesting litmus test, but unfortunately, we kind of go back to your one of your original points, Charles, that, you know, we're in this world where primaries, you know, whoever has a couple thousand dollars and can win a primary, because the way states draw their maps, you know, that's all it takes really to kind of slide through into Congress. And then, you know, Congress is in the shape it's in. Do we think that there's any hope of, you know, bringing people to the table to debate ideas and then elect people who are going to be, you know, the adults in the room, the Coxes of the world that can make, you know, better changes and make things good for everybody. So it's not just, you know, us versus them.
Right. If you're an evidence-based guy, there's not much evidence of it. I think, though, let me step back and say, I think, though, that the problem, well, when you come to the midterms, normally the party that's in power, yeah, loses. So it will be a big change if the Republicans can manage to keep control of both houses.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If they can't, all the Democrats will do is attack Trump with committees. Yeah. And it won't be positive. It'll just be he's bad. The larger issue, it seems to me, for Republicans is the following. And there's one sort of always issue, which is the biggest threat to Republicans, is a downturn in the economy. That would always be a threat to whoever's in power. And the fact that interest rates seem so high now has squeezed a lot of younger people out of the housing market. And that's clearly a big issue. Democrats now call it an affordability issue. And I think that's a good way for them to put it. I think, yes, that the larger issue here is that the country has fundamentally transformed the way we are governed since the Lyndon Johnson era. We are now far more than ever in American history governed from Washington. And we are governed by very large bureaucracies. That has been compounded in recent years by the fact that the split between the two parties is such that it is very difficult to pass any laws because they can be blocked in the Senate. And that has led presidents to govern us by executive orders. Well, those are the things we, right, we revolted against when King George III did them. But there's almost no other way to govern, it seems. Now, in that context, the problem that has split Republicans, and I think now has in a way been resolved within the party because of Trump's not only won personally, but transformed the party into a MAGA party, is that you can't, if you're a conservative, what you believe is small, slow steps. They may be more, you may be seeking to roll things back a little, but you move in a small way. The problem is that basically all that does is pause this large movement, which began with Lyndon Johnson, and the keystone was put in place by Barack Obama with basically universal health insurance. But it was Johnson who put in place Medicare and Medicaid, and then and then Obama added to it with Obamacare. But if you're going to do anything to change that, you can't. The Republicans recognize that you can't just do it in small steps because you'll never be able to roll that back. And nobody's going to try to roll back some of the biggest things. But that, I think, is why it's not just that Trump is a populist. It's that I think he wants to do much more than you can do with traditional conservatism.
It's the he's the Silicon Valley, you know, move fast and break stuff mentality. That's just reformative or transformative, really. But it winds up, you know, unfortunately, it sounds like, you know, we can notice it that people can't keep up with it. And on the left, and now, and I don't know, unfortunately, probably wasn't the word I want to use there, but the left, and then is now chasing their tail because they're not used to this. And now we've seen them spiral into chaos. And I think, you know, without having strong leadership, I mean, I go back to the idea that our culture is being frayed, and the outcome are these atrocities. And I think you made a good point earlier, Charles, with the idea that, you know, street level violence and just, you know, the run of the mill crazy people are doing things to they're awful are always going to be part of a free society. But the political targeted stuff is something that we should be able to, especially since, you know, First Amendment, you know, the first one is speech. Why do we even allow that? Where do we begin? You know, I want to be a teacher. I mean, I love the idea of debating and talking about stuff. I grew up in a household where my mother was, you know, a conservative. My father was a liberal, and we talked about stuff all the time. And it's why I'm more of a centrist, and I've never really liked the idea of party politics and assigning myself to a party, because I feel like both sides have good ideas for different times and for different, you know, contexts. Where do we begin to get people back on track? I mean, I feel like teaching little kids to debate is a great idea, but is it realistic?
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. I taught a class before I retired from teaching. I taught a class for some 10 years or so that was called Core Western Values: Free Speech, Government by Consent, Religious Toleration, things like that. We had some weeks that I called the dark side, where we would look at slavery or racism or anti-Semitism or other things that I didn't want it to be everything is bright and shiny. But we had genuine debates in that class. And I think the story is not that people at the University of Chicago or Yale or Harvard or Stanford or University of Illinois or UIC or wherever it might be, Northwestern, lack diverse views. I think that they feel uncomfortable about expressing them because they don't just think that they'll be put down. They think that they'll lose friendships.
It's a sad, you know, state that we feel like that. Have Charles, I mean, you're a study, you know, scholar of U.S. history and beyond. Is there a time when we've been this cloistered in our own views? I mean, I can't think of anything. I mean, I can't think of a time where we've been so afraid to be outright with, you know, our opinions, like you said, to lose friendships or to be ostracized within our own communities.
Well, community is an interesting word in itself. One of the things that has that we have a lot of social measurements of is the decline of a sense of community. But I grew up in a small town, about 2,000 people, and people knew that you had different views, and there was a lot of toleration of those differences. But there were some differences that wouldn't have been tolerated, and there was a lot of social pressure on it. One reason people moved, let's say you were gay in the 1960s and you were in a small town, there were two problems. One was that there were a lot of people who thought that that was fundamentally immoral, and they had religious beliefs for it. And the other was that if you were in a small town, there weren't a lot of other gay people that you could be with in a supportive community or that you could date or whatever. So those people moved in my area. They moved to New Orleans, or in out west, they moved to San Francisco or a big city. You know, in the east, there were a lot of big cities. So I don't want to idealize that world. And I do think that in an earlier time, John, you're a student of the history of media. There used to be, the people who read the Sun-Times didn't read the Tribune because yes. of different views. And if you went back a little further, there were a lot more papers, and each of them picked out a small ideological or ethnic segment.
And they had their columnists to reflect those views, right?
Exactly. And in fact, that was one of the problems that John faced in his final years at the Tribune. After the Tribune had moved very far to the left, the fact that John was a more conservative columnist, it wasn't pressure from the readers that he was facing. It was pressure from inside the newsroom. We shouldn't have this voice in the paper.
Yes, and you were one of those few that stood up for me, and Jeff too, and I'll never forget that. And gentlemen, my hat's constantly tipping in your direction.
Well, I appreciate that, but let me say something about that, John, because I don't think that the public really understands.
All right.
John was one of the early people to criticize what is now well-known Soros prosecutors, right? Mm-hmm. These left-wing prosecutors that let everybody out on the street. This goes back to our earlier point about sort of not random violence exactly, but non-political violence, if you will.
Why didn't they listen to me?
Yeah.
I could have saved them.
So then what happens is that I'd say two things happen. One is, and this was the most important, if you disagree with somebody, you often look not for a real argument against them, but a way to damn them right. with whatever you think will work. And in the case of John Cass's opposition, they said, oh, if you're against Soros, you must be against Jews. Well, I just thought that was ludicrous, and I happened to be in a position where I could say something that had a little weight, at least.
Appreciate it.
To say that it just wasn't true. It wasn't true about John, and it wasn't true about nearly everybody who criticized Soros. Now, you could criticize Mayor Brandon Johnson, let's say, for being left, but you could criticize him just because of his race. And the fact that someone criticizes him, let's say, because was a member of the teachers union and seems to not have any clue as to what he's doing politically, doesn't mean that because you're criticizing him, you're a racist. But some people would grab for that. And it's really, really important to push back against that, because otherwise the main effect is not just on the person who's attacked, but it means it suppresses all legitimate speech where people can say, this is a bad mayor, or these are bad prosecutors, and they're getting a lot of outside funding, and we should understand that they're part of a larger movement. And that was the effort. But in the case of the people who were attacking John, what they were really doing was saying, we want a newsroom at the Tribune that doesn't have people like him. And they were just picking up, they were just throwing anything at the wall that they thought would stick. And this was foul.
But these were journalists. That's the irony of this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, that
was.
Wow,
yeah.
But you still see it. I mean, we shouldn't just think that it's one off or it's about Soros or about false claims of anti-Semitism or whatever. It's right. Just you just see this all the time, and in fact, you often saw it. Let's go back for a moment to Charlie Kirk.
Yeah,
I saw a lot of what I would call mirror imaging. That is, people who knew they disagreed with Charlie Kirk said, well, I favor toleration of gay people. And Charlie Kirk is on the opposite side of me for many issues. Therefore, he must hate them.
But he didn't.
He didn't. But right. I saw this with otherwise kind of reasonably intelligent people, but they simply said, if I think X and this person is generally on the other side from me, then he or she must think not X on everything. And it's just not true.
Well, if you're living in a cabin and you're focused entirely on demonology, you might think that way, like Stephen King did when Charlie Kirk died. But the fact is that Charlie wasn't like that. However, I think his death, he died doing what he loved, professing his love for Christ, but also engaging young people in the battle of ideas.
That is so true.
And oddly, the hard left and to some extent fundamentalist Islam can't deal with.
Well, I think the issue with Islam, which is very fundamental in what's going on in England, I would make 2 points about it. One is that you have a lot of politicians who either want the votes from that community, or they think that somehow taking a strong stand in favor of clear speech or whatever would be somehow hurtful to them politically, or stepping on people who are on lower social rungs or considered whatever, and that it's the opposite of might makes right. If they're weak, they must be right in some way. I think that's wrong. I think the bigger problem actually with large Muslim populations in the West is that it is a cultural world in which there's been no clear distinction between the world of religion and the total life that everyone should lead, not just people in that religion, but everyone else, where there have been people going around to supermarkets and just ordinary supermarkets and demanding that those supermarkets not sell any pork or anything. That's just a sense that is so different from what we fought so hard for centuries in the Western world, which is to create a civil space in which people could make their own choices and would not be ruled by others, and could simply make their own choices. And I think that Europe and the UK have yet to really confront that problem. In fact, they've made it worse and worse and worse.
And it's happening too in the United States, is it not? Where that discussion, people going around telling shopkeepers you can't sell this product or that product because it's against our religion, that's happening here.
I think it's perfectly reasonable for somebody to go in and say to the shopkeeper, I'm not going to shop here because you sell that, and I'm going to tell my friends not to shop here. But as soon as you start to intimidate somebody, you have crossed a bright line. And I think, though, our basic society is not that intolerant, and we have a lot of protections for those merchants. The problem is we don't have district attorneys, dare I call them Soros DAs, who won't prosecute for that. That's just intimidation, and it carries a real threat. And I don't know what the laws are, but that sort of thing really is intolerable, and we need to stop it.
You know what I think? I think we need to have someone to come forward to talk to us about tolerance in our debate, like Professor Melissa Click. Anyone remember her?
Oh, geez. Oh,
God. Yeah. Can we get some? Can we get some strong
muscle.
Arms muscle here?
Yeah. Bring me some muscle over here. Right?
We need some muscle over here. This was at the University of Missouri to stamp out people who disagreed with her.
Yes, and I thought, and now I guess apparently she's teaching at Gonzaga.
Gonzaga, yeah.
Gonzaga, which is a Catholic university. By the way, I think that there's an issue with religious universities and that we've been too intolerant. So what we used to have were private universities as distinguished from public universities. So the University of Illinois at Chicago is a public university. Free speech rules and so forth apply there and all the like. But Loyola is not a public university. DePaul is not a public university. University of Chicago is not a public university. Northwestern is not a public university. The problem is that all those universities take so much public money now that they are effectively public and private. They're
Hillsdale College.
Huh? The only, that is the one of the very, very few. So Hillsdale not only doesn't take money for its professors and their research, it doesn't take money for its students. And as soon as you start taking money for your professors and students, the federal government says, well, hey, you can't do X, Y, or Z. Not or because, as Ole Miss was in, say, the 1950s, it was segregated, and that's against our civil rights laws, but because you're taking federal money for your science research, and we won't let you take it unless you obey every other rule that we have, including rules for, let's say, transgender women, biological males in women's sports. So if you don't do that, we don't give any money, federal money, for sports. But if you don't do it, don't do what we say in sports, we won't give you money to do biological research. And this has now come out, and people are outraged that the Trump administration is doing that to Columbia and Harvard and so forth. What they don't know, but I do, is that the federal government has done that for years on the other side. And you just never heard it because universities conceded to those demands almost immediately. And because newspapers didn't think it worthy of being reported. I saw it firsthand. And so what's happening is not new. What's new is that the Trump administration is using it for their own purposes and conservative purposes and not the liberal purposes that the federal bureaucrats in the Department of Education did for year after year after year.
The irony. I mean, then people are raising their, you know, ire to it, saying, oh, no, how dare they? And I think to your point, Charles, to use a term the kids use, it gives me the ick in general because I don't.
To get in with the cool crowd, aren't you?
That's right. Yeah. Hey, you got to get them where they are. We can appreciate that, definitely.
I do have to credit my professors in college, and most were liberals, but they weren't left-wing hard lefters, right? They were liberal professors who were about the Enlightenment. They wanted us to enlighten ourselves, to read, to think. And all that's been shut down in recent years. And that's why Charlie Kirk was so valuable and will be so missed because he was about enlightening people.
And he really was.
He didn't really care was. What your politics were. Just talk to me. Prove me wrong. That was
the name of his tent, and I think it's important that people remember that. That's what I think has been maybe the biggest...
casualty, yeah.
Yeah, well, the biggest casualty in one sense, but also the biggest revelation, I think, to a lot of people in seeing all of this, the days of memory of Charlie Kirk, is what that he really was about speech and engagement, and not about shutting people down. There were certainly people, religious people, who will say that his main message was that he was a man of faith, and I think that there's a lot to that. But I think his main message to the wide public is that he was someone who believed in debate without demeaning your opponent and without personalizing it. So the right argument is not that classic sort of Rodney Dangerfield joke. He goes into the doctor and he says, "My arm is hurting me." And the doctor said, an inspection, and says, "I think the problem is that you've got a little arthritis in your shoulder." And Rodney says, I want a second opinion. And the doctor says, "You're a jerk too." And our public discourse is filled with that second opinion, and we've just got to get away from it.
Yeah. Right. So we need to end the us versus them-ism. That's the thing that, like you said, John, and your professors, you know, who are liberal, and they weren't teaching you it's, you know, us or not. It's
here. I've got a solution to this problem. Remember what Conan the Barbarian said. What is best in life? And he said, to drive your enemies before you, to listen to the lamentation of their women. I don't think, is that what we want? Like, that my side wins and you're going to be weeping? I don't think so. I like the Charlie Kirk idea better. Let's talk about it. Prove me wrong. Yeah, I love that. Thank you, Charles. And
thank you, Charles,
for letting me quote John Milius.
Thank you both, John and Jeff. It's always such a pleasure to talk with you.
Or Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago. I call him America's professor. And for Jeff Carlin, future physics teacher, WGN executive producer, my friend, baker of pies that I never get. And for me, John Cass, editor-in-chief of johncassnews.com, where you always get a good cup of common sense. And note, you want to write for the website, John Cass News? You want to advertise for the website? If you have a business you want to promote, contact me at john@johncassnews.com. Join us again next time for another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.